Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we are going to be discussing a very special topic, when peace fails, unraveling the persistent collapse of negotiation and peace agreements in conflict zones in Africa. I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Isaka Sware. Dr. Sware is currently Senior Governance and Mediation Advisor and is also a lecturer at General Lansana Conte University of Symphonia in Conakry, Guinea. He's also former member of the United Nations standby team for senior mediation advisors and former special advisor to the African Union High Representative for Mali and the Sahel. Isaka, I'm very, very pleased to have you join me. You've had quite an impressive resume, and I look forward to a very fruitful conversation with you.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, brilliant. So I was reading, let's start off with this. I was reading a report that was made by, I think it was 2018, by the Nordic African Institute. It's titled Peace Negotiation and Agreements in Africa. And in that report, they say why they failed and how to improve them. So they've cited the United Nations Peace Agreement database and say nearly half of the peace agreements in the world, around 42%, is in Africa. But despite the peace agreements, we've seen that peace has remained elusive in Africa. We've seen, you know, conflict in Africa. Why is that so?
Well, I would say it has been elusive in many parts of Africa, so that we do not generalize. And also, it has been elusive in many other parts of the world, although we are focusing on Africa. Well, there can be many reasons to that. And again, you cannot generalize. It would be case specific, although there are common factors that one can speak of. So when an agreement has been reached, it is often reached under specific circumstances in terms of the buy-in of the parties, of the good faith of the parties. So, and the calculus of the parties. So sometimes if one or more parties were not engaged in the peace process in good faith, and their calculus changes. In the mediation jargon, we have a term we call BATNA, that is the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. That means if at one stage, actually even before parties get to an agreement, sometimes you would be asking, but why are they not getting to the negotiating table? Because one party think that they have a better alternative to the agreement. That means they think they can decisively win the war. So that is before the agreement is reached. Once an agreement has been reached, that calculus can change. When you were signing, perhaps you were in a weaker position and things have turned in your view in your favor, and then some may renege on past undertakings. That's one. Two, well, the level of trust also can be affected, because when people go to war, it means that the level of trust is very, very low. The agreement seeks to rebuild that trust. So once that has happened, if that is not sustained for whatever reason, that can be a reason also for the collapse of the agreement. Thirdly, there are challenges inherent in the implementation of an agreement because it's a compromise document and sometimes very, very painful compromises. So faced with the challenges of implementation, including sometimes between those who signed, negotiated the agreement and the many other people, followers, if it's a head of state, the population, who may not like certain clauses of the agreement, and therefore the negotiators or the signatories having to negotiate within their SIM camp, that could also lead to some challenges. And if then they come to want to renegotiate parts of the agreement and the other party is not ready to that, these are some of the many factors that could contribute to the collapse of a peace agreement.
Very, very interesting. We've seen over the years, starting from the 90s, you know, in Sierra Leone, in Lesotho, in Burundi, in these places, even in Rwanda and all of those places. And then we've seen in recent times, we've seen Somalia, Ethiopia, we've seen other places. Well, do you think there's been a pragmatic shift? So I guess the question is, how has peace negotiation evolved in Africa over time? Has there been, has there been a kind of shift or change, massive change?
Both in Africa and elsewhere, peace negotiations have complexified and further professionalized. Complexified because conflicts have complexified. You have more actors, issues are very complex. That's why now we're talking about multi-dimensional conflicts. It doesn't mean that didn't happen before, but they are more occurring now. Mm-hmm. And so you would have a conflict where you have several actors that you need to negotiate with. I remember, for example, deployed by the UN in the Central African Republic in 2017, where the government of that country had to negotiate with 14 different armed groups that had convergence on certain issues and two to divergence on other issues, and you need to negotiate. So that is complexification of conflict. Complexification or professionalization of the process. Well, with the complexification of the conflict comes also the complexification of the negotiation and mediation processes. Because if before the habit was that you would have a single mediator or facilitator, now it's very, very common to see a panel or a college of mediators, several individuals representing several entities. You would see, for example, the UN, the African Union, and a regional organization, even a member state, all together putting hands to negotiate or facilitate the negotiation of an agreement. And so that is a complexification, but because also mediation specialists have learned from the wealth of experience in the past, that has led also to the professionalization or further professionalization, whereby we now have what we call process design. For example, before you go to a mediation process, you really think about the architecture of that process. This is something that is relatively new, so that has added to the professionalization of mediation processes.
Talking about our process, I'm talking about the mediators, whether we're having single mediator, whether we're having multiple mediator. I think critical to the peace agreement is also the morality or the moral stance of the mediator. And we've had a case where, so I wanted to comment on the difference, because we've been seeing places where, like, for instance, you see, let's say in Mali, I think sometime last year, the Kunta government asked the UN multi-whatever team to leave Mali. And we've also seen other places, several other places, maybe in the Congo as well. And we've been seeing, even if we can say that these are like authoritarian governments, we've also seen that there have been less, well, I say credibility, whether the UN, maybe people are using credibility in the UN's ability to be a mediator, and some of other people's credibility as a moral, unbiased, impartial mediator. How can you comment on how this college, like you rightly say, if I use that word, college of mediators or credibility, in terms of credibility, how does it affect that peace agreement?
Well, there are certain fundamentals that any honest peace broker must be aware of, and qualities he or she must have for there to be trust in their ability to facilitate a peace process. Key amongst those is impartiality. That is, that the mediator or facilitator, whatever title he or she takes, does not have vested interest in the outcome of the process he or she is facilitating or mediating, such that that would affect their impartiality vis-a-vis the conflict parties. And in your introductory question, you mentioned something, although not implicitly, the acceptance of the mediators by the conflict parties. Another fundamental of mediation is consent, because conflict parties must accept you implicitly or explicitly as the facilitator or the mediator. And that acceptance is based on their perception of your impartiality and your competence facilitate and steer the negotiations among them. Now, that can be obtained or assumed or presumed at the beginning, and you may then lead the process to its conclusion. But then sometime after that, well, the implementation could be faced with some challenges that were the thrust of your first question when we started this conversation. So now you mentioned certain cases in Mali, etc. These are other dynamics that could lead a country to say to the UN, we want you to leave, but that is not necessarily related to these of the qualities we are talking about.
We've also seen, speaking of impartiality and vested interests, in my own research, I've always said, if you look at what happened in Libya in 2011 with Gaddafi and stuff like that, I've always come to the conclusion that not having an interest is, you know, it's we're not facing reality. It's been a missionary, like, people usually have interests. You talk about Rwanda in the DRC, or talk about Rwanda in these places, there's definitely interest. Or talk about the Rwandan force in Mozambique, there'll always be some interest in these places. But how do we reconcile that interest with the outcome of peace? So I guess that is what the in my own opinion, I don't know if you agree with that, is how do we reconcile that vested interest? Because if you look at the United States, for instance, and look at in Uganda, and how Rwanda and Uganda are forces that support the UN, you know, war against terror, kind of like mantra. But then there's forces as well, are ones that are considered to be authoritarian in a certain way, and they don't face. So I guess, how does that complicate? How does vested interest complicate the negotiation process?
You're raising important questions that can be nuanced in specific context. Yes, your interest that can affect your impartiality, can be a liability for you as a mediator. But then we make a difference between neutrality and impartiality, because some of the things you raise in could also hover around neutrality. And for example, if you're a United Nations mediator, there are certain normative issues that you uphold, about which you cannot be neutral or indifferent. That is, for example, the language used by the African Union. You cannot be indifferent. But it doesn't mean you cannot be impartial. Actually, impartiality is procedural neutrality. Let me take a metaphor from football. You're a referee. So if you're a referee in football, it means you like football. And therefore, you have some clubs, you have some, you like some players. So you like the way Lionel Messi dribbles and handles the ball. The referee between Lionel Messi's team and another team. When he has the ball, you're happy in yourself. But when he does something that is punishable by red card, you should show him red card. So by you liking the way Lionel Messi plays, he's not being neutral. But by you showing him red card, he's being impartial because you are actually following the procedure and the rules. And that is what should happen. Now it comes, and from your question also, a situation where someone really is impartial, is partial, like has a certain relationship with one party. But if that entity or person uses that as a leverage, because you can pressure your friend to give in. So you take the United States in the Israel-Palestinian conflict. The United States is not impartial in that case, but it is the United States that actually can make things move there, because they can use their leverage of their special partnership with Israel to put pressure on Israel to do things that no one else can do if they want to be an honest peace broker. So, you know, it is complex, but nuanced also in these matters.
Very, very interesting. You mentioned the AU and the UN, and you've worked with both of them. In Africa, we've seen where there are conversations about African problem, African solutions for African problems. And, you know, you've seen such trajectory towards there. How do you compare the UN and the AU? Because we've seen the AU also taking some kind of like lead position in this, let's say in Somalia, for instance, and in some of this place. How do you compare the AU's approach to the UN approach? And what do you foresee? Do you think that you can take a more firmer or more center position in the future?
Yeah, well, it depends on various issues. The UN has a global mandate. The AU has a regional mandate. Both are allowed in the United Nations Charter. Article Chapter 8 allows regional mechanisms to undertake peace-making efforts in coordination with the United Nations. And the African Union and the United Nations have been working very, very closely. That I can attest to, because I have worked for both and been in discussions on intricate issues on which both worked together. So they would have doctrinal difference in certain regards. For example, in peacekeeping, when the UN sends a peacekeeping mission, say to Mali, to DRC, the doctrine of UN peacekeeping is that they are peacekeeping. They are standing between the warring factions. And that is why, actually, to deploy a UN peacekeeping mission, the ideal condition is that there is a peace to be kept. That means there is an agreement, and they are working on the implementation of that. So they do not engage in offensive operations except in defense of the mandate. That is, a faction is attacking them, or is attacking civilians, because the protection of civilians is part of their mandate, that, and that attack is imminent. Whereas the African Union and other regional economic communities or regional economic communities like ECOWAS, for example, could have a peace enforcement mandate, that is, go after an armed group that has proven obdurate to gestures of peacemaking. So that is one main difference I can think of between the two in terms of their doctrinal approaches. But they have been working very, very closely, actually together. You would recall, for example, in Somalia, there was a hybrid United Nations African Union peacekeeping force. So that is the head of the mission is jointly appointed by both organizations. And also with complementarity in that the United Nations support financially and logistically the African Union mission in Somalia.
So speaking of Somalia, let's bring it to more specific terms now. So we've been seeing in recent times, you know, there was a peace agreement between Somaliland, like an MOU between Somaliland and Ethiopia that kind of like raised tension between Ethiopia and Somalia. And I think there's currently a very difficult negotiation. I think it's Turkey now. I think Egypt as well is negotiating that agreement between Somalia and Ethiopia. Can you comment on this particular case?
Not only with Ethiopia, Somaliland, you would have various countries that have red lines in their foreign policy. And when you look at the history of how Somaliland came to reclaim its independence in a chaotic moment for the Federal Republic of Somalia in the early 1990s, you can see the reaction of the federal authorities in Somalia at any action they deem supporting the disintegration of their country, almost like China and Taiwan. Any country that supports Taiwan, China sees that country as supporting disintegration of China. So that is the backbone of that contention. Other than that, I think Somalia and Ethiopia have enjoyed good relations over the last few years. If in the 70s they had a problem over the Ogaden that Somalia claimed, and also at times when you didn't have a functional state in Somalia, where sometimes the authorities in Mogadishu accused authorities in Ethiopia of supporting some armed factions. I think we have gone past that period, and that bone of contention about Somaliland is not unique to Somalia-Ethiopia relationship, but to any other country that would recognize or support Somaliland.
So most of the... So I think Somalia and Ethiopia is one of the few ones that is between two countries, you see the distinction. But in Africa, it seems to be like many of the discord and the peace accord or peace agreements is usually between a country, the state government and non-state within the party. I'll come to that in a minute. But in Sudan at the moment, we have two warring parties that seems to be of even power. So you talk about the RSF and the Sudan armed forces. And then we've seen negotiations from the regional, maybe from Kenya. We've seen from the AU. We've seen interest from, you know, that conflict seems to be very, let me use the word, complexified. Why is that so? What is going on in that conflict?
Well, to your first question, I mentioned that there are many factors that could explain the collapse of a peace agreement, but also that could actually make it difficult to reach a peace agreement. And here we are at that first stage in Sudan, in that the two parties, that is the rapid support forces of General Mohamed Daglo Hemeti and the Sudan armed forces led by General Burhan have so far not managed to sit around negotiating table to reach an agreement and put an end to this fratricidal war that has brought havoc on the Sudanese population. A number of factors, I think. One is that Batna I mentioned. I think that both parties must think that they can still win this war on the battleground, even though experience now more than 2 years seem to almost more than a year, almost seems to point to the illusionary nature of that thinking at this stage. A second one, in my view, is the division among the civilian actors in Sudan. I think the civilian actors, I had the opportunity to deploy to Sudan several times in 2002, even in January 2013, a few weeks before the war started. And the civilian actors are very divided. Some consider themselves as the true revolutionaries, and that others are not, and others think that, no, we should all be in this to have this. A third one, in my view, is also is the division among external actors that support different factions. And so these are some of the reasons that have made it difficult so far to read it. But despite that, in my view, there is reason to hope in that you have various actors. You mentioned the United Nations, the African Union, IGAD, that are very, very active, but also individual countries. You would recall that the few humanitarian truces that have so far been reached between the parties have been facilitated mainly by Saudi Arabia and the United States. And so you have these efforts. And particularly over the last few months, when you have a reinvigoration of these efforts, that the United Nations has appointed a high-level personality in the person of the former Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtan Lamamra, and the African Union has appointed a high-level delegation led by the former Executive Director of ECOWAS and very, very experienced Ghanaian diplomat Mohamed Ibn Shambas. And these are trying to work together to reach an agreement. It's not easy, but I think one path of a million miles starts with one step.
Very, very interesting. It still comes down to the stuff we're talking about, because you did mention the key thing is how in conflict I could look at maybe the civil war in Nigeria in the 60s. Look at how if look at the literature and how people say it prolonged because of the external support. People look at how external support in itself can prolong a conflict. And usually people would think if one party is stronger, it's better to let them, because I've seen with the Palestine and Hamas, Israel, where some parties would say, let Israel just finish it quickly. And, you know, and I think that's an illusion, you know, in modern day warfare, to think one party holds all of the cards to be able to finish. Conflicts are not like in the conflicts in the pre-Cold War, kind of like conflict where you can just finish quickly. And we've seen that also with ECOWAS and the alliance of Sahel states, that the newly formed stuff. So I wanted to talk, you mentioned ECOWAS, you mentioned Algeria, you mentioned a lot of these places, but we've also seen that so let's say with Morocco and the Western Sahara, we've seen recently with France recognizing the Western Sahara. We've seen in the Sahel with Russian influence and the tension between ECOWAS itself and these states and these people living. And then recently we've seen the Niger-Nigeria path. How do you see all of these dynamics?
These are different situations with different dynamics. If we take one or two of them in turn, you mentioned lately Western Sahara issue. Just a correction that what France did last month is not to recognize Western Sahara, but to recognize or support Morocco's autonomy plan for Western Sahara as the acceptable solution. And that situation has been going on between Morocco, that claims that the territory considered as Western Sahara is part of it, and the Polisario Front, which is a liberation front, that rose to say that that territory never belonged to Morocco. And so they started a war because the territory was occupied by Spain. And when Spain left in 1975, you had the problem on the territory. Mauritania came to claim part, and Morocco went to claim part, and the Polisario Front fought both until Mauritania left that in 1978. And the OAU, the ancestor of the African Union, led negotiations until 1984, when Morocco left the OAU in protest at the recognition by the OAU of the Arab Democratic Sahrawi state proclaimed by Polisario. And then the United Nations has taken over then about the issues of having a referendum, et cetera, et cetera. And that has stalled because the two parties continued the war until 1991, and then that process continued. And now we are at a stage where Morocco is saying, what I can offer is autonomy, and Polisario is saying, no, let's have a referendum in which autonomy would be one of the options, but other options should be there, including independence. And then you have the big powers actually positioning in support of this party, in support of that other party. But the United Nations is managing
this situation.
That process. Now, on the ECOWAS IS issue, IS is the Alliance of Sahel States that was created last year by Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. And that came after a military coup that happened in Niger on the 26th of July last year that toppled President Mohamed Bazoum. And the ECOWAS didn't like that because it goes contrary to the established norms. And ECOWAS threatened military intervention. And these other countries that are led by military juntas also coalesced to prevent that from happening. Perhaps they thought that if ECOWAS managed to do that, then they could embolden ECOWAS vis-a-vis their own transition processes. I think ECOWAS, and they have actually decided to withdraw from ECOWAS, even though Article 91 of the ECOWAS's revised treaty calls for a 12-month period of notice, that when it's like you want to quit a job, you don't just tomorrow. And that comes to post on the 28th of January if the three countries do not withdraw their notice of withdrawal. And ECOWAS, at their last meeting in July, appointed the new Senegalese president to mediate that process. And that president is busy doing that, and I think he has many favorable factors that could allow him to succeed in that regard. But I think just to finish on that, what that is about is this issue of an unconstitutional changes of government or military coups. We have had a rise of those over the last few years, actually 5 years. We have had nine military coups, including double coups in Mali and in Burkina Faso, which are contrary to established norms that you should come to power and maintain power through democratic means. But then it comes also against the background of what some called democratic backsliding, in that the trend that was actually being consolidated in the region in terms of peaceful democratic changes has been put into question by certain sitting leaders who have manipulated their constitution and went for third terms that are very, very controversial. And ECOWAS has been trying actually to prevent that through the reform of a protocol on governance and democracy, but that has been stalled also by some countries. So that is the situation. So the problem now is for ECOWAS to try to manage these transitions, but also try to prevent further transitions. And I think to manage these transitions is to work with these countries over their transition roadmaps, how to assist them to restore constitutional order, but at the same time also work on that supplementary protocol so that ECOWAS can also deal equally with civilian sitting leaders, because currently the protocol provides a 6-month perimeter that within 6 months before elections, you are not allowed to engineer any substantive changes to the laws related to the constitution, to the election, mm-hmm. including the constitution. Mm-hmm. But countries mm-hmm. like my country, my former president, Alpha Conde, well, engineered mm-hmm. that before the 6 months. If you do that one, mm-hmm. you have actually disarmed ECOWAS legally, but politically it's mm-hmm. incorrect. And people would be mad at ECOWAS when ECOWAS actually could not do anything about that. So ECOWAS is trying hard to have that one pass. And so it's four member states that have been blocking it to resist from that because they are doing harm to ECOWAS mm-hmm. and also exposing themselves also to these dangers and the region with them, unfortunately.
I'm glad all of this. You see, I'm so happy to hear this, Kamal. It's very, very deep analysis. And this borders to the current research I'm doing on stabilization and democracy, where my current research is looking at how democracy or liberal democracy, or definitely liberal democracy in Africa, is fueling militarization. I'm glad you mentioned that. So because sometimes we focus too much in, you know, the authoritarian end of the military coups and don't look at the root causes, or we focus so much on stabilization. So my argument is there's so much focus on let's just make a place stable, there's conflict, rather than dealing with the root causes, rather than dealing with those triggers, looking at the sitting supposedly democratic government that are now yielding the dividends of democracy to the people, and then creating an environment for this to happen. So I guess the question is, I don't know if you agree with me, that the overt focus on stabilization rather than dealing with these root causes, rather than dealing with the imperfection of the kind of democracy that we practice in Africa, it's what is causing some of these peace agreements not to have a lasting effect. Is that what is causing it? Is it contributing to its collapse? And how, you know, can you expand more on that? I don't know if you agree with my assessment.
So on the issue of military coups, as I mentioned, you have to both look at it in both ways. What you're saying, I wouldn't say root causes, but conditions or factors that create conducive environment, because mm-hmm. it is not clear whether military leaders who have come to take power were genuinely concerned about issues with mm-hmm. regard to mm-hmm. democracy. But clearly, if there were not problems with these governance issues, perhaps mm. they would not have a pretext or a conducive environment to do that. So the way I look at it is that, one, military coups are not an alternative to democratic civilian rule, even faulty ones. Mm. And the military should not give itself a license to intervene. And because, of course, politicians would make mistakes, including if military become politician. And if you want to punish every political mistake by a military coup, you will not finish. Mm-hmm. And so there should come a time when the military should say, these political messes that a politician can make is not our business. Politicians mm-hmm. should do that one. But we will mm-hmm. not allow ourselves to be used to oppress the citizens who rise against faulty politicians. I think mm-hmm. If the military does that, I think we would go a long way. That would be my first point. And I think this is what we see in Western countries, where you would have a lot of protests, a lot of things that at the minute in many African countries, the military jumps in. The military should stop that. And we see that in Ghana, there has not been a military coup or an attempt for a successful one since 1981. In Benin, that used to champion military coups, nothing since 1972. Nigeria since 1993. That is where we should go. Then secondly, now we work on civilian leadership, because we should not say, no, just the military, no, it's the civilian. And that is why I'm saying that ECOWAS efforts to reform a supplemental protocol so that it can also hold civilian leaders accountable in the same way as it holds military leaders accountable is key. And the ordinary citizens, organized ones and civil society organizations, have an important role in this regard. And thirdly, to say, while we have challenges with democracy, Well, with the application of democracy, not democracy, those who are elected on the basis of the ethos of democracy, and they violated this same ethos. We have problems with that, but that is not something that we should also generalize. We do also have good examples that give us hope. For example, while in the last 5 years, there have been 9 effective military coups, in the same period, there have been 11 cases of peaceful leadership change on the continent, including 5 that involve the defeat of the sitting leader. The latest is in Liberia, for example, where George Weah was defeated and he accepted. And then you can also think of Zambia in 2001. You can think of Malawi in 2000, etc. And also we have had in that same period also 6 cases where the sitting leader came to the end of his constitutional terms, accepted that one and left, including in Nigeria, where President Muhammadu Buhari served his 2 terms, handed over, he organized elections in which he wasn't brought, and Uhuru Kenyatta in Kenya, et cetera, et cetera. And in on the whole, for example, since 1990, we have now 33 African heads of state who have been defeated in elections. And we have other 33 other countries, other leaders in 20 countries who have served their terms and left power. That gives you 66 peaceful changes, and that is not all. So it's to say that while we should also condemn the vote on democracy, we should also celebrate and be hopeful on these good examples, and then force bad ones to follow the good and positive steps of these good ones.
I agree with 100%. And in my recent book, when I was looking at Nigeria's militarized democracy, I was looking at how democracy, since the return to democracy in 1999, we can always focus on the negative without looking at the progress that has been made. So I do agree with you with your very, very rich assessment. But if we come to the conclusion and summarize all of these things that you've mentioned and bring it back to the peace agreements and say, how can we improve? First of all, how can we improve this peace agreement? I think the key question is, why do we have so much conflict in Africa? And how do we prevent? Because it looks to me like when we talk too much about peace agreements, we're talking about more dealing with the symptoms rather than dealing with the real thing. So how do we start to make Africa a place with little conflict to begin with? I wanted to conclude on that note and just give
you used a very appropriate term. How do we prevent? Because before we get to the peace agreement, that means that the peace has unraveled. What should we do so that the peace maintains? Well, that is by respecting the principles of good governance. And many African conflicts can be traced at least partly to problems to do with governance. And these problems to do with governance could be the genuine concern of those who want to fight against government, or the instrument that these actors want to exploit. But you exploit something that exists. If it didn't exist, you wouldn't have it to exploit. I think the first thing is to ensure that the governance principles various countries have adhered to in their constitutions, in their various legal texts, are upheld. Secondly, I think it's to ensure that we have equitable distribution of the wealth of our countries and equitable treatment of various segments of society, of regions of society. Because when people feel left out, discriminated against, they would harbor resentment vis-a-vis whoever they hold responsible. So when someone comes to say, hey, I can organize you, you can follow me, we can fight these guys, well, they are easy prey to such entrepreneurs. So the second way, in my view, is to make sure that we have equitable distribution of the resources that our countries are endowed with, and that we treat all the citizens fairly through justice means. And thirdly, in my view, because you could have all of these, but still you would have some people for personal gains that would want to cause problem. That's where comes the role of African regional organizations. Those at the regional levels, ECOWAS, SADC, IGAD, etc., and the African Union. And the problem, in my view, that I see with these organizations, as far as these issue of peace and security is concerned, is one of upholding the norms that have been adopted at their own level, but that difficulty comes from the fact that they are the sum of their member states. So if member states in their individual countries do not uphold these norms, it's difficult for the African Union. But all the more the reason for them, for the African Union to be strengthened. And I think to ensure that African Union and other regional organizations in Africa have financial autonomy. You have financial autonomy, and it is the responsibility of African countries. It's a shame that today, majority of peacekeeping efforts or peacemaking efforts of the African Union are supported by external entities like the European Union, the United States, and individual European countries. That's a shame. So member states have to provide the resources to the African Union, because that will not only be for peacekeeping, but it will allow the African Union to support member states, even in development terms. And that would, in my view, prevent certain conflicts. But when there are signs of a conflict, to intervene early on when it is cheaper, easier, before actually guns can start speaking. And when you do that, if you rely on someone, well, for someone to give you money, you must prove the imminent danger or the actual danger when you want to actually intervene before danger materializes. It's you who can put your own money to do that one. So I think we work within our countries for those who are holding power to uphold the principles of democratic governance, and for them also to have a fair distribution of the resources, but also individual citizens to hold them accountable, because often we complain our leaders are doing this, but we are electing them. And when election time comes, we clap for them because they have distributed a few Naira bills, a few France Safa bills, et cetera, et cetera. Citizens are as responsible as leaders. So I think citizens also should take up their responsibility to account, to hold accountable their leaders, but our regional organizations also should assist in this regard, because united we are stronger, divided we will be weak, particularly in a globalized world.
Wow. Thank you very, very much, Dr. Soare. This is a very brilliant assessment of the situation. We're very grateful for your deep and rich insight. And yes, we're indeed very grateful to have you.
It's a pleasure. And thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
For tuning in this week episode on our peace agreement in Africa. As usual, join me to welcome to thank Dr. Isaka Soare for his very brilliant and rich insights into why conflicts persist in Africa and why peace agreements collapse and what we need to do to prevent conflict in Africa. I implore you to join me again next week for another exciting episode. Until then, stay blessed.